Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both the Saturday Show and the Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.
Right off the top here, I do want to tell you that in just a few moments, we're going to be joined live by Democratic U.S. Senator Chuck Schumer. When the country learned this weekend that the Democrats would hold on to their Senate seat in Nevada this weekend, that Catherine Cortez Masto would be reelected as a Democratic U.S. Senator from Nevada, we also learned in that moment officially that Democrats will numerically retain control of the Senate next year. Senator Chuck Schumer, the majority leader of the United States Senate, is going to be joining us here live in just a moment. I have so many things that I want to ask him about what is about to happen next here. But first, as Chris and I were just discussing, just in the last half hour, we got in new vote numbers from Maricopa County, Arizona, which is the population center in the state of Arizona. Those numbers turned out to be decisive in the very closely watched race between Democrat Katie Hobbs and Trump-endorsed Republican Carrie Lake. NBC News has now projected, just within the last 15 to 20 minutes, that Democrat Katie Hobbs is going to be the winner of that governor's race in Arizona. And that means a lot for Arizona. It also means, you know, bigger picture, that Republicans lost the marquee U.S. Senate race in Arizona. They lost the marquee governor's race in Arizona. They also lost the hotly contested, fraught Secretary of State's race in Arizona, where the Republican candidate had all but said that he wouldn't allow Republican election results to be certified unless they showed Republicans winning. I should mention, though, that the Arizona Attorney General's race is not called at this point. The Arizona Attorney General's race is between a Democrat named Chris Mays and another Trump-endorsed Republican named Abe Hamadeh. That Arizona Attorney General's race has consistently been a closer margin than the governor's race, although you see there's, you know, about 4,000 votes between them. Again, though, the governor's race has now been called for the Democratic candidate. The Arizona Attorney General's race is still, at this point, too close to call. With all that to understand and with anticipation of what else we might hear over the course of the night, no rest for the wicked. Let's go right back to MSNBC national political correspondent Steve Kornacki at the big board. Steve, we got the call. We know the top line result out of Arizona. Can you tell us anything about, based on what's still outstanding, how narrow the margin is likely to be at the end of the day in this race?
Yeah, I mean, there's still some possibilities here that this could get closer. One variable here is, how are the provisional ballots, the ballots that were cast provisionally, is subject to post-election verification, how are they going to break? We actually saw Donald Trump in Arizona do fairly well with those back in 2020. There's another issue in Maricopa County. That was by far the bulk of the vote that just came in Maricopa County that put Katie Hobbs over the top in the governor's race. There's still a small share, a couple thousand we're talking here, votes that were cast. If you were following on Election Day, there were some issues at polling places throughout Maricopa County. Ballots were sort of, voters were having some issues being able to cast ballots. They were placed in ballot box three, they're calling it. So there are still a few thousand of those. They are Election Day votes, voters who went to the polls to vote on Election Day. We talked about how the Election Day voters are a more Republican-friendly group, generally speaking. So there's a possibility there that in that few thousand that remain of Election Day votes in Maricopa County, there could be room there for Republicans to have some success there. Not so much in terms of, obviously not in terms of the outcome of the governor's race, but you mentioned it. I think that looms large, what I'm describing right here in the race for attorney general, where the margin for the Democrats is 4,100, basically 4,200 votes, 4,195. The uncertainty I'm describing around how the provisionals will break, about how those remaining same day votes will break in Maricopa County, about there is sort of a scattering of votes from these various counties around the state, scattering of sort of types of votes from these counties around the state. Exactly how that will break as well, I think, is what's going to determine this attorney general's race, where Hamadeh is certainly still in it. He's within striking distance, at least theoretically, of Mays after that last update from Maricopa County. That's just the difference between being 4,000 behind and being 20,000 and change behind. Is there's just, even with all those uncertainties I'm describing, you can't see a way for Lake to overcome a 20,481 vote deficit. Her campaign, again, they had banked so much on that idea that that vote that just came out of Maricopa County, the mail-in ballots that were hand-delivered on Election Day, it's just a huge, huge chunk of the vote in Maricopa. Almost 300,000 of the votes from that county were cast that way. They had really banked a lot on the idea that that was going to be heavily Republican, consistently like 60% plus Republican. And she just hit, she had one of her better updates with it just now, but she only hit 57%. So it just wasn't hitting her numbers there. With that vote, the folks on the Senate side, the Masters folks, were talking about, you know, a couple of days ago that was going to lift Blake Masters in the Senate race. It clearly didn't. So, you know, Republicans in these late votes coming in out of Maricopa County have been making up ground, have been doing well sort of just in the raw numbers, but not enough to overcome the advantage that Democrats had built in at least three of these races. But again, that attorney general's race is the question mark. And I should add, too, the other piece of this is Arizona is crucial for the battle for the control of the House of Representatives, where Republicans still don't have those 218 seats locked up. There are two, you see them in gray here, two outstanding districts in Arizona. Democrats, if they want to have a path to 218, these are two very important districts. And here, this is Maricopa-based, first district, Republican Dave Schweikert. That last update, see, it was good for him because he was down, his lead was under 1,000. Now it sits over 3,000. With that update. See, so it was he was in a better position coming in than Kari Lake was. He benefits from these votes. So now Republicans are feeling a lot better about their standing in the first district of Arizona and in the sixth district, too, where tonight that Republican lead has grown to 3,500. So it's interesting, as Democrats are now gunning for a statewide sweep in Arizona, it's very possible they could go 4-for-4 in those statewide offices. The other news out of tonight out of Arizona concerns control for the House in two districts that the Democrats, I think, really, if they want to stitch together a 218 scenario, may be slipping away from them at the same time.
Steve, in terms of the overall status of the House, again, this is not an exact science, but in terms of the remaining House races around the country that are still undecided, do you expect that we're going to have enough results? We're going to have races potentially called tonight in any of those races? I'm thinking about whether or not we're going to be looking at a projection of House control by one of the two parties sometime soon.
Yeah, I mean, what you can see here, here's what you're looking at. This is, you know, red are the Republican one, blue are the Democratic one, yellow are the uncalled. There are right now 212 Republican seats in the new House. There will be at least, and there'll be at least 206 Democratic seats. There are 17 that we have yet to call, that NBC has yet to call. So Republicans would need six from this list. They need to pick up, they need six seats here, and they get to 218. So I just showed you Arizona 1. They got very good news out of Arizona 1. Arizona 6, they got very good news out of Arizona 6. We haven't called either one of those races, but Republicans definitely today and yesterday, for that matter, out of both districts, got numbers they were looking for. What else on this list is looking like it's trending in their direction? There are a few. New York 22, for instance. Almost all the vote is in. Republicans are sitting on a lead of over 4,000 votes. This is the Syracuse area. It's hard to see. Just as I say, it's hard to see. We're saying it was hard to see the math for Kari Lake. It gets hard to see the math for the Democrats in a place like this. The 45th district of California, we got new vote update just within the last hour. Michelle Steele, the Republican, her lead actually expanded a little bit over Jay Chen. Two-thirds of the vote is in right there. The 27th district here, Mike Garcia, the Republican, leading by nearly 10 points over Christy Smith. Christy Smith all but conceded this race on Twitter yesterday. You know, the 41st district of California, now we're into about two-thirds of the vote is in. Ken Calvert's lead has expanded by about 1,400 votes or so this evening. So what's sort of emerging here, New York 22 is one, California 45 is two, California 27 is three, California 41 is four, Arizona 1 could be 5, Arizona 6 could be... I could have just given you the six seats there that would get the Republicans to 218. if the Republicans go 6 for 6 in the seats I just showed you, and they're feeling good about their standing in all of them right now, that's 218. So the Democrats need to stop them, need to win one of those, at least one of those 6 I just showed you. And then they would need some more. Democrats would need some more breaks, because you would take a look at like the 22nd district of California. This one's been extremely slow to count here. But David Valadao, the Republican incumbent here in the Central Valley, with a lead just under 3,000 votes. This is one Democrats would need to pick up. We've got the Lauren Boebert race out in western Colorado. I don't think we're expecting to learn more about this until Thursday or so. But Boebert does have that advantage of 1,100 votes right there. So I'd say right now, if you look at this, the path to Republicans getting to 218 is clear, what it could look like. But getting all of those races actually called, especially given the pace of the vote count in California, may be a different story, may take a little bit more time, just because, again, you take a look at a race like the 41st in California. It's 5,400 votes. You still have a third of the vote to come in. There's still a little bit of uncertainty there, perhaps, in some of these races.
Patience, Grasshopper, patience. That is what we are learning here. Steve, much appreciated, my friend. Thank you so much. Feel free to interrupt at any time if you get something determinative.
You got it.
All right. Reiterating our top story tonight, NBC News has just projected, just within the last half hour, that Democrat Katie Hobbs has defeated Trump-endorsed Republican candidate Carrie Lake in the Arizona governor's race. Now, after a call like that, what happens next in Arizona ought to be simple and straightforward. We know how these things are supposed to work, right? The loser concedes defeat. The state certifies the election. We all agree that we will shake hands and battle it out again in the next election. In Arizona, it is not as clear this year that that is what is going to happen. The losing Republican candidate for Arizona Secretary of State, Mark Finchem, who I mentioned earlier, he posted on Twitter just hours ago, quote, "We are not conceding and are fighting." If you were wondering what exactly he's fighting, since his projected loss 3 days ago, Mark Finchem has been posting conspiracy theories on social media about George Soros and also cryptocurrency. I don't know. The losing Republican U.S. Senate candidate in Arizona, Blake Masters, has also so far refused to concede. On Friday, he told Fox News that Maricopa County should stop its vote count and start all over from scratch. He has since said that he will concede if he loses. He actually lost. He says he will concede if he loses after every legal vote is counted. Not to be outdone, former Republican President Donald Trump has been calling for not just a recount in Maricopa. He's calling for a completely new election in Arizona. Didn't work out the way he wanted it to, and so he wants the election to be redone. His candidates lost. Therefore, it must have been stolen, or at least we should just do it again anyway. His former advisor, who's now a podcaster, Steve Bannon, says that somehow the results in Arizona should not be certified. He said on his podcast that the certification in Arizona should somehow be blocked. I don't know how he intends to do that. But it's an open question what Carrie Lake is going to do now that NBC News has projected that she has lost the race for governor. Both she and the Republican candidate for Arizona Attorney General, whose race has not yet been called, they have both been alleging voter suppression against their voters somehow in Arizona. Just a couple of hours ago, Carrie Lake went on Fox News and called the election in Arizona, quote, botched. She said she does not know what the remedy for that should be, but she said she doesn't know how you can certify an election that was so clearly botched. She also said she just knows that the people of Arizona wouldn't vote for her opponent, Secretary of State Katie Hobbs. Remember, Arizona has been the site of some intense protests sparked by election denial, including armed protesters turning up outside the Maricopa Vote Counting Center after the 2020 election. That same vote counting center is now the site of some renewed protests. The protests are certainly smaller than 2 years ago. That could also be because of the heavy security barriers and fences and sheriff's deputies that officials felt the need to put there this year. Joining us now from Arizona is Yvonne Winjet Sanchez. She covers voting issues in Arizona for The Washington Post. Ms. Sanchez, thank you very much for joining us tonight. I appreciate you being here.
Thanks for having me.
So, first of all, let me just ask you if anything that I've described about the situation in Arizona is the wrong way around, or if I said anything wrong. And also, let me just ask you to update us based on your reporting in terms of how people are responding to the results there.
Sure. I think you've conveyed everything exactly how it has played out. We are all very closely watching Carrie Lake to see how she is going to maneuver her way through this. Her entire campaign for the past year plus has been premised on the notion that an election was stolen from former President Donald Trump. She seems to be hearing from various voices, including the former president, about what her next move should be. She clearly thinks that this election was botched. She's citing problems with printers that had issues printing out ballots on demand. On Election Day, county officials have repeatedly said since Election Day that everyone was able to cast their vote, that no one was disenfranchised. Yet she seems to think that there might be some sort of legal path forward to try to contest some of the results that perhaps are being accepted on Katie Hobbs's behalf. She's trying to figure out, is she going to go all in on the stop the steal notion? Is she going to go all in on do not certify? Is she going to at some point acknowledge that she lost? And I think that that remains an open question. She's been holed up at times over the past week with various Republican operatives, some of whom are trying to press her to concede, to walk away, and to continue to have a place in the Republican Party, not just here in Arizona, but beyond. But there is another crowd that seems to be advocating for her to go a little tougher, perhaps taking a page out of Trump's playbook post-2020.
In terms of the atmosphere in Arizona, I think that when you're anticipating potentially anti-small d Democratic developments, one of the things that you have to think about and sort of gaming out the likely eventualities is how many Democratic opportunities there are for people who feel aggrieved to have their concerns addressed within the system. To that end, if Carrie Lake and we saw people like Steve Bannon today start problematizing the idea of certifying the election, is there any legal means, is there any within the process means of trying to block or delay or challenge the certification? And similarly, is there a provision by which Carrie Lake might simply ask or be granted a recount given the closeness of the vote?
And that would have to go all the way up through the court system, I presume, at some point on some of these various issues. We're going to get that. We're going to see what this looks like, perhaps. The Board of Supervisors has said repeatedly over the past several months, anticipating that there could be problems like this, that they would certify this election. This is a board that came under intense scrutiny in 2020. After Donald Trump lost, Kelly Ward, the state Republican chair, Rudy Giuliani, others were trying to get these supervisors to not fulfill their duty to certify the election. This board has said, we are going to do our jobs. We are not going to be intimidated out of doing our jobs. So we'll see what the messaging ends up looking like, what any sort of legal maneuvers could develop over the coming days from Lake's camp. But as far as the Board of Supervisors is concerned, they're going to be certifying the results.
Yvonne Winjet Sanchez, Washington Post reporter covering Arizona voting issues, joining us tonight upon this big news that the Democratic candidate has been projected as the winner in that big governor's race. Ms. Winjet Sanchez, thank you so much for your time tonight. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. I know we are on day six of this election now, but it is important to know that there's a whole bunch of races that are still nail biters with significant political impact. Take, for instance, the race for the state House seat representing the 142nd legislative district in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. I know you've been laser focused on it at home. That race is currently separated by 114 votes. But I'll tell you why that race has potentially national implications. Right now, Republicans have 100 seats in the Pennsylvania State Legislature, Pennsylvania State House. Republicans have 100 seats. Democrats have 100 seats in the Pennsylvania State House. It is 100 to 100 in Pennsylvania right now. Pennsylvania Democrats have said that they are going to reclaim the Pennsylvania House, which I think would be the first time in more than a decade that they have been in control there. But there are three races left there to be called. One of them will be settled by a special election because the Democrat who won that seat handily last week had actually died before Election Day. That seat will likely go Democratic again. Then there's that Bucks County race that's separated by 114 votes. Then there's a Montgomery County, Pennsylvania race, which is separated by 14 votes, literally 14 votes. So partisan control of the Pennsylvania State House and all that means. It might change hands for the first time in 12 years, but it's going to come down to one race that's about 100 votes and one race that's about a dozen. Just in case you needed motivation to know that your vote really counts. Also, we're looking at the mayoral race for the second largest city in the country, Los Angeles. That race is still up in the air. Also, the Wisconsin Secretary of State's race is separated by 0.3% of the vote, with 99% of the vote in. Right now, the Republican candidate for governor in Alaska is way ahead of his opponents, but Alaska is a ranked choice state, so that race is also still a live wire until the ranked choice system gets its way to the end. And then, of course, there's control of the U.S. House of Representatives in Washington. As Steve was just saying, there are 17 races left that could shift the partisan control of the House. We'll have more on that to come tonight. But first, we're going to be speaking to the man who now knows he's going to be the majority leader of the United States Senate again. Democratic Senate Leader Chuck Schumer joins us live here next. Stay with us.
The UN Refugee Agency, or UNHCR, responds to emergencies and provides long-term solutions for refugees. They provide aid in over 130 countries, including Ukraine, Syria, Afghanistan, and Sudan, where people are forced to flee from war and persecution at their greatest moment of need. UNHCR helps and protects refugees by providing food, shelter, medical care, and other life-saving essentials. The agency jumpstarts relief in three key ways. They transport core relief items stored in even the most remote areas of the world. They deploy expert emergency staff trained to help in crisis situations. And they transfer funds directly to support the emergency. Because of generous supporters and donors, UNHCR can scale up its response within 72 hours of a large-scale emergency. Your support helps provide life-saving aid for refugees whenever and wherever emergencies occur. Donate to USA for UNHCR by visiting unrefugees.org/donation.
The Republican Party has a choice. They can continue to let the MAGA hard right lead them. That is a path to failure. Or the group who is not MAGA can work with us on important issues to benefit the American people. I say to the Republican senators and to Leader McConnell, we are willing to work with you to get things done for the American people. It's not going to be everything your party wants, for sure. It's not even going to be everything we want, but it'll be a lot done, and we're not going to forsake our principles for it, but we will get it done.
That was Senator Chuck Schumer speaking yesterday. The first time Senator Schumer learned that his party had won the Senate and he would be majority leader of the U.S. Senate was on January 6, 2021. While the attack on the U.S. Capitol was underway. January 5th, 2021 was the date of the two Senate runoffs in Georgia. It was on January 6th, while the Capitol was under siege, that the results came in showing the Democratic candidates had won those Georgia runoffs. The Democrats had therefore won control of the Senate, and Senator Chuck Schumer would take over as the man in charge. That was how he learned last time. That was the circumstances of how he learned last time. This time, much better vibe. This time he learned it at a Chinese restaurant while he was out to dinner with his wife on Saturday night. On Saturday, with the win of Nevada incumbent Democratic Senator Catherine Cortez Masto, Senator Chuck Schumer learned over fortune cookies that against all odds, against history, the Democrats would hold the Senate and he would stay leader. With Senator Cortez Masto's win in Nevada on Saturday and Mark Kelly's win in Arizona the night before, I should tell you that Senator Schumer also now maintains his perfect record of having every one of his Democratic U.S. senators reelected since he has been their majority leader. None of them have been ousted. The Georgia runoff election this year will determine the size of Senator Schumer's majority, but it will be his majority either way. Joining us now live is Senator Chuck Schumer. Senator, thank you so much for making time to be here tonight, sir, and congratulations.
Yeah, it was good at that restaurant. You know, people got on their emails that we had won, and the whole restaurant broke out in cheers. It was just wonderful.
Oh, wow.
It was a great moment.
I hope you,
a lot different.
I hope you left, right. a, hope you left a big tip.
Thank you. I'm a big tipper.
So let me get your response tonight to this new news that we've just had within the last half an hour or so, 45 minutes, out of Arizona. NBC News is now projecting that the Democratic candidate Katie Hobbs has defeated Republican Kerry Lake in that state.
Well, it's first great news, obviously. Kerry Lake was a very dangerous person. She's very smooth talking, but very, very dangerous and had hard right views. And if she is defeated in a state like Arizona, which is a purple state, it should send another message, another shockwave through the Republican Party, that when you embrace this MAGA Republican right-wing extremism, you lose. Candidate after candidate had lost, who just about every one of the extreme people who wanted to undo the next election, who denied this election, all lost. And as I've said, I hope this is a lesson to the mainstream Republicans. Now, we don't agree with the mainstream Republicans on so many different things, but I hope it's a lesson to them that if they embrace this MAGA Republican Trumpism, they're going to lose. The American people, this is one great thing, Rachel. A lot of people doubted the fidelity to democracy, and with reason. We saw the election deniers. When you deny, when you're a political party that denies an election, that's the beginning of autocracy, the end of democracy. So they saw these election deniers. They saw the violence on January 6th. They saw much other threats of violence, even against innocent poll workers who were just trying to do their job. And they said, democracy's eroding. And the American, but democracy's roots, they may be quiet, but they run deep. And the American people, not just liberal Democrats, but moderates and even conservatives said, this MAGA Republican Party is against everything that democracy is all about. I can't vote for them. And I predicted this in August. I said there was going to be about 10 to 15% of the electorate who normally might vote Republican, who is going to not vote for them because of this embrace of MAGA. So my hope, my plea really, to the non-MAGA Republicans in the Senate is work with us. We will be willing to compromise because the second reason we won is we got real things done. We took on big oil and got the biggest climate bill ever done. We took on pharma and finally put a limit on prescription drug prices. We took on the NRA and actually passed some good gun legislation. We did, the people saw two things. They saw us fighting for things they cared about and succeeding, and they saw the Republicans at the MAGA extreme. And they put those two things together with the fine candidates we ran who were very decent, honorable, and very successful, effective people. And that clinched the election for us. This will happen again if the Republicans continue to embrace MAGA. So the warning, the clarion call to the non-MAGA Republicans is work with us. And people say, well, they won't. Well, one other point. Of the six major bills we passed in June and July and August, which woke America up that we could do things, five were bipartisan. The big one, IRA, was not, because Republicans wouldn't do anything on climate, wouldn't go after pharma. But things like the gun bill, the CHIPS bill, which brought American jobs back here and said we're not going to let China take over our, or any other country, take over our chip fab industry. The bill that said the Veterans Administration had to deal with those veterans who were exposed to the burn pits. All of those and many other things passed in a bipartisan way. And so I'm hopeful, and I'm an optimist, you know me well, that they're going to do that. They're going to say that path doesn't work. We don't need every Republican to do it. We don't even need half. We just need a group that we can work with. And we're willing to meet them part of the way. We're not going to give up our principles, but meet them part of the way to get more things done for the American people.
Let me ask about one of these that's going to come up fairly quick. I understand that you today filed cloture on a bill to codify marriage equality, to make it federal law that same-sex couples have the right to marry. I mean, clearly you are worried that the conservative majority on the Supreme Court is going to, you know, is basically coming for people's marriages and they're going to try to take away that right. What is your expectation in terms of moving cloture on this today? There will be the first votes on Wednesday. Are you expecting Republicans to join Democrats in supporting
this? Our two lead Republicans on this, I asked two people to be our leaders on this, Tammy Baldwin and Kyrsten Sinema. And they came back when it first came that in the House, 30 Republicans voted for marriage equality, much to our surprise and delight. Put it right on the floor, some people said. Well, Sinema and Baldwin, our leads on this, said to us, we're not going to get the votes if you do it now, but we're quite certain that if you do it after the election, we will get it done. And, you know, my job is to get things done. Get things done. I know that some people said, just make it an issue. Show where the Republicans are. But the American people, and particularly LGBTQ plus people who want the right to marry, and by the way, it's sort of personal to me. I have a daughter who has a beautiful wife, and they're expecting a baby in a few months. Isn't that great? people want us to get things done. People want us to get things done. And I'm optimistic based on what I know and what our two lead senators know, that we will get the votes to get this done. And it'll say to that Supreme Court, just like we want to say to them, get your hands off women's bodies. We want to say, figuratively, of course, we want to say to them, let people marry who they love, period.
Your majority will either be 50-50 with Vice President Harris as a tiebreaker, or it will be 51-49, depending on what happens with Senator Warnock's runoff election in Georgia on December 6th. Can you explain to me and to our audience what the practical difference is in terms of how the Senate runs? I mean, obviously, you've been at 50-50 these past couple of years. It required a power-sharing agreement with the Republicans. How different would the Senate be? How different would your life be? How different would your ambitions be if it was 51-49 instead of 50-50?
It's not 1% different. It's very different for the better. For one thing, anytime a judge or a nominee to the administration, we've had a lot of good progressive nominees, gets a vote out of committee that's, you know, 10-10, that's tied, it delays things for a week. You have to go to the floor, you have to get the time, and you have to bring Kamala Harris there and do what's called a motion to discharge out of committee. If we have 51, there'll be no more motions to discharge. It will mean appointees and judges will get appointed much more quickly. And, you know, we've had a great record with judges. We've set the record as of today, actually, 83 new judges, 2/3 women, half people of color, and progressive judges, not just partners in law firms and prosecutors, but legal aid attorneys and immigration lawyers and consumer advocates, things like that. So that'll make that a lot easier. The second thing it does is you can get different bills out of committee much more quickly. Third, we can have subpoena power. With 50-50, you can't really get subpoena power. So it means it's a lot easier to get things done. And one other thing, when you have 50 senators, and obviously any one senator can say, I'm not voting for it unless I get this, this, or this. When it's 51, it's harder to do. So you put all that together. Plus, that extra seat helps us in 2024 keep the majority. I'm always trying to think ahead. It's a world of difference. And Raphael Warnock is just a great person. He's been a great senator for Georgia. Service has been his motto, whether as a minister, head of the Ebenezer Baptist Church, as a senator. He's the person who took the lead on getting insulin in Medicare only to cost $35 instead of the $600-800. He's one of the people who's taken the lead so that disadvantaged farmers in Georgia, poor farmers, will get some help. They have been discriminated against in the past. He's one of the people who took the lead on expanding the ACA so more people got health care and it was cheaper. Issues that really matter to people, Warnock has already produced. So if I was a Georgian, and this race is going to be decided only by Georgians, I'd say, this guy produces for me. It's not a lot of rhetoric and bombast. It's serious stuff.
Senator Schumer, one last question for you. That the point that you just made a moment ago about how any one senator, when it's 50-50, can stand up and decide they're going to throw a wrench in the works. You know, if it's not what I want exactly, then I'm going to stop everything. This is a little bit delicate to say, but we all know that it was really Senator Sinema, who you just mentioned a moment ago for her leadership on the marriage equality bill, and also Senator Manchin in West Virginia, who were the ones who were kind of throwing the wrench in the works more often than anybody else. Are you 100% sure that neither of them is considering switching to the Republican Party so they could be the star once again in an even bigger way so that they could sort of monkey wrench this whole process?
Well, they've had very difficult positions. I've disagreed with them rather strongly in many ways, but they've kept being Democrats. It would have been easy for them to do it, you know, in the past. They have strong beliefs, different ways. Senator Sinema is passionate on LGBTQ rights. Senator Sinema is leading pro-choice. She wouldn't find much of a home in the Republican Party there, I suppose. Their Manchin has been very progressive on certain issues as well, including prescription drugs. And so, I think they differ from us in many ways, but I don't think either of them would be comfortable in the Republican Party.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, who I should mention was himself just reelected and who also is about to start another term as Majority Leader in the United States Senate. Sir, it's an honor to have you with us tonight. Thank you so much and congratulations.
Pleasure's mine, Rachel. Good to be with you. Thank you.
All right. We got much more ahead here tonight. Stay with us.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
This did look like trouble at the time. This was the headline. Comey and McCabe, who infuriated Trump, both faced intensive IRS audits. Michael Schmidt at The New York Times reporting in July that of all the tens of millions of taxpayers in this country, somehow two of the people Donald Trump hated most got picked, supposedly at random, for an audit so invasive that tax lawyers joke about it as an autopsy without the benefit of death. That was the Times reporting back in July. Now, that already troubling story has gotten significantly worse. Trump's longest-serving chief of staff, John Kelly, the one you see holding the door for his boss here, John Kelly now tells The New York Times that, yes, those audits were instigated because Trump asked for them. Quote, yes, Trump wanted IRS investigations of his foes. John Kelly telling reporter Michael Schmidt, quote, I would say it's inappropriate, it's illegal, it's against their integrity, and the IRS knows what it's doing, and it's not a good idea. Kelly says Trump responded, quote, yeah, but they're writing bad things about me. For the record, the former president is denying these allegations from John Kelly. A spokesperson for the former president called John Kelly today a psycho. That was what the spokesperson said. He's a psycho. That's nice. Why'd you pick a psycho to be your longest serving chief of staff? But this is a big deal, and a potentially criminally big deal for anybody at the IRS who might have gone along with this kind of improper pressure, and also for Donald Trump, if he, in fact, asked for this sort of thing to be done. It is a federal crime for anyone, including the president, to request, even indirectly, an audit of anyone. It's against the law to abuse the power of the IRS in that way. If Trump asked for it, it's illegal. If Trump asked for it and the IRS then did it, it's illegal on a couple of different levels. When this story first emerged this summer, it appeared likely that the Treasury Department would investigate the issue. We're told tonight that a report from that Inspector General investigation is actually expected quite soon. If we get anything definite, we will let you know. But for now, you can add this new reporting on the potential criminal actions of abusing the power of the IRS. You can add that to the pile of legal worries that the former president has arrayed against him right now. Just today, he defied a lawful subpoena to testify to the January 6th investigation in Congress. He today remains in legal jeopardy in the state of Georgia, where a grand jury continues to investigate the effort to overturn the 2020 election results in that state. Georgia Governor Brian Kemp is reportedly testifying in that federal grand jury, in that state grand jury criminal investigation tomorrow morning. Trump also remains in legal jeopardy over the classified documents he's alleged to have taken when he left the White House. Plus, his company is actively on trial right now in New York on criminal charges of fraud. Plus, the New York Attorney General is continuing a civil suit against that company for alleged fraud. And so, of course, in that propitious environment, Donald J. Trump has decided that tomorrow is the perfect day for him to announce that he's running again for president. Right? Since everything else is going his way anyway, and people are just clamoring for his return. Nobody has ever declared a run for president, not just under a cloud, but enveloped in a suffocating fog of scandal, with legal jeopardy still unfolding across multiple states and jurisdictions. Nobody has ever announced a run for the presidency under those circumstances. But for whatever reason, that is apparently going to change tomorrow. Congratulations to us. Presidential history about to be made on our watch in the worst possible way. Watch this space. We expect that tomorrow the Republicans in the House of Representatives are going to hold their internal leadership elections. Congressman Kevin McCarthy is the top Republican in the House. He is planning to stay leader, to become leader of something, depending on how House control lands in the next few days. He may still be minority leader. He may be speaker if they get control. Right now, according to NBC's projection, Republicans could get, say, 219 seats, which would give them a very, very, very tiny majority. I should tell you that projection has a plus or, excuse me, it's 220 seats is the projection right now. Has a margin of error, though, of plus or minus 4 seats. And so even if they do get control, it's going to be a very, 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 very slim majority. We've seen a few tiny House majorities in history. Washington Post actually did a good reminder today of when we have had really, really, really wafer-thin majorities in the House in the past and what the consequences have been. One of those rare instances was right as the U.S. Entered World War I. Another one was right around the events of 9/11. In both of those cases, big world-changing world events ended up sort of outpacing what was otherwise expected to be total partisan gridlock. But there's other cases where partisan gridlock ended up being what held the day. And that can be a very consequential thing, too. In the spring and summer of 1932, we've talked about this a few other times on the show, tens of thousands of U.S. veterans, World War I veterans, marched down Pennsylvania Avenue, and they set up camps outside the U.S. Capitol in Washington. It, of course, was the Great Depression. The veterans came to D.C. to demand bonuses that they were due. The government had promised them bonuses for their active duty service, and they hadn't paid them out. And so the veterans came to Washington to get their money. They called themselves the Bonus Army. It ended horribly when the veterans refused to leave. President Herbert Hoover called in the U.S. military and sicked the military on them to throw the veterans out bodily. Now, how did it get to that point, to that act of desperation by the veterans and that monstrous decision by President Hoover to sic the military on them? Well, it was gridlock. Congress had debated the awarding of those bonuses for years. There was some congressional support for them. Republicans at the time were opposed to paying the bonuses. They had a one-seat majority in the Senate. That was enough to bottle it up in the Senate. The House had a Democratic majority, but it was a really small one. It was a 219 to 212 majority in the House. Too small of a majority for the Democrats to be able to get things done there either. That's the sort of thing that can happen with a very, very slim majority in Congress, particularly if you've got a slim majority in both houses. I mean, unless you've got some sort of major world event that unites political enemies, partisanship can very easily block even very important stuff when majorities are that thin in Washington. Now, there's been a lot of discussion about what it would take for Republicans to be able to pass legislation in a very narrow majority in the House. I think in real politics today in 2022, looking at the House Republicans and what they want to do, I don't think anybody expects them to actually have real legislation that they want and expect to pass. I mean, even if they did have goals for legislation, they've been quiet about them thus far. They didn't run on those goals, and they're not going to want to pass anything that the Democratic-controlled Senate would vote for anyway, let alone something that would be signed into law by Joe Biden. What I think that means for a wafer-thin Republican House majority, in practical terms, in all likelihood, it means that we will see them pass nothing in terms of legislation. The consequence of them having a majority, even a one-seat majority, is that they will control the committees. and they will therefore control subpoena power, and they will therefore be able to turn themselves into an investigation machine, a scandal-generating body of government, where they investigate everything Joe Biden has ever done, thought, eaten, drank, or gestured at in his entire life. That is going to be the consequence of the House going to the Republicans, if, in fact, that is the way it goes. A narrow majority is a recipe for them passing nothing. I doubt they care very much about that. But even a one-seat majority is what they need to be able to control the committees, launch investigations. And honestly, that's all they want anyway. Watch this space. One quick reminder before I go, I have a podcast you might have heard about. It's called Ultra. It's been doing great. I'm really proud of it. It is 8 episodes in total. Episode number 7, second to last episode, just posted online today. It is a doozy. You can listen to Ultra for free anywhere that hosts podcasts. Just go to msnbc.com/ultra to check it out. All right, that does it for me tonight.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both The Saturday Show and The Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.